From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Governor Snyder strikes a deal with Enbridge to replace its Line 5 with a tunnel.
We think this announcement missed the boat. We think that the governor actually failed to address what's the key issue, which is, how do we protect the Great Lakes right now?
Parents pulling their kids out of one school to send them to another time and time again. What's the price of all this school hopping?
The reality is that a student who keeps moving and moving and moving and moving is going to have lower and lower and lower scores.
A new biography of Betty Bloomer of Grand Rapids, who became First Lady Betty Ford.
She said that the day she entered the White House in 1974 was the saddest day of her life.
Plus, who is on the hook to pay for cleaning up PFAS contamination? Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Governor Snyder announced an agreement with Enbridge Energy today that could eventually lead to replacing its Line 5 pipeline that runs under the Straits of Mackinac. The plan would be to build a tunnel, but that still doesn't sit well with at least one member of the governor's Pipeline Safety Advisory Board.
We're very disappointed that the governor didn't listen to his advisory board and the people of the state of Michigan on this.
We'll hear why later in the hour. But first, today is count day, a crucial day for schools across Michigan when the attendance count helps determine just how much funding every school will get. In Detroit, many of the kids present in one school today could be going to another by the spring count day next February. That's because one in three Detroit elementary students changes school each year, often right smack in the middle of the school year. It's called school hopping. Bridge Magazine and Chalkbeat Detroit investigated the city's enrollment instability for a series called Moving Costs, How Students Changing Schools Hurt Detroit Classrooms. Erin Einhorn of Chalkbeat Detroit is with us now. Erin, you and Bridge's Chastity Pratt-Dossie took a very deep dive into this. Describe what the school hopping looks like in Detroit. What did you find?
Well, one of the things that we did with this project is that we focused on one eighth grade class at Bethune Elementary Middle School in Northwest Detroit. And there were 31 students in that class, and we asked every one of them, how many schools have you attended? And we found that the average student in that class had been to 4.5 schools. And there were 5 kids who'd been to more than 7 schools on their road to eighth grade. And interestingly, of the 31 kids in the class, a third of them, 11 of them, enrolled in this school in the eighth grade. So right before they're going to high school, they're changing schools.
I found it very stunning that in some cases, a student couldn't even remember the names of the schools that she'd been to.
For sure. I mean, if you've been to 4 or 5 or 6 schools and, you know, you're 13 or 14 years old, they all start to run together. And sometimes they were there a very short period of time. And this has all kinds of consequences for teachers, for the students themselves, for schools. And that's one of the things we were trying to document in this story, is all the many ways that this affects classrooms and affects learning in significant ways. So much so that educators say it's one of the most difficult things that Detroit schools are dealing with.
Now, do schools get any heads up when one child leaves or arrives? I mean, do teachers know what the new student has been taught and any records traveling from the old school to the new school? Because certainly you would think in a perfect world that would happen.
You would, and a lot of states have data systems, you know, similar to when you go to the hospital and they can pull up your records from your doctor's office. And Michigan is developing one that will be online in a few years. But for the moment, a new student arrives in school, and it falls to the school secretary to call the child's previous school and say, hey, send over the records. And it can take weeks. And meanwhile, a teacher's got a new student in their class. They don't know where that child is. Are they, you know, advanced? Are they behind? Do they need extra support? Does this child have a behavioral history that would be helpful for the teacher to know? So if you have new kids coming, you know, every week or every other week, and you have to scrap your lesson plan for the day to get a new child acclimated, you know, that can be very, very disruptive to a classroom.
Erin, what are the common reasons kids are school hopping?
Well, so when we first started this project, we assumed that it was going to be a lot of the consequences of poverty, unstable housing, foreclosures, evictions. But actually, when we started peeling back the layers a little bit, we relied on some research from a couple of professors at Wayne State University who looked at all of the students who changed schools between 2014 and 2015, and they found that only 40% of them had moved to an address in a different zip code, meaning 60% of them, well more than half, chose to move.
And what were the reasons they did that?
I mean, Michigan has very robust school choice laws. There's no restrictions on how many charter schools can open, and you have schools of choice where you can go to another school district. You have lots and lots of options. And in Detroit, we have very, very low quality. So you might be in a school and be very unhappy with what's happening there. You know, we talk to parents and they say, you know, my child didn't have a certified math teacher all year, or that school wasn't safe. I didn't feel safe there. My child was threatened, or my child was bullied, and I'm not going to stay in that school. And parents in Michigan have been taught, you know, over the last 25 years where we've had these school choice policies, that choosing is good, that it's what good parents do. It's the best thing you can do for your child. If you're in a bad situation, you have choices. You don't have to stay. You should move. And so they do. And you try one school and it's not very good. And you go to another school and it's not very good. And you go to another school and it's got problems as well. And so you keep moving.
So then you get it. The result is like the youngster who said, well, I have seven schools by eighth grade, which is pretty mind-boggling. If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with Erin Einhorn of Chalkbeat Detroit about her series of reports done in conjunction with Bridge Magazine and Chastity Pratt Dossey. And it's called Moving Costs, How Students Changing Schools Hurt Detroit Classrooms. Erin, talk to us a little more about the kind of impact this has on a student's emotionally and socially, and also in terms of learning and test performance.
Yeah, there's extensive research on the impact that changing schools has on children. A child who has moved schools outside of an ordinary, you know, between elementary and middle school or middle and high school, a child who does one move like that is going to have lower test scores. They're going to have more behavioral problems. They're going to be more likely to drop out. Another thing that really surprised me in the research is that it's not just the kids who are moving who are affected, but also their classmates. So a student who's in a classroom that's experiencing this disruption of students coming and going, their test scores are lower too.
And to that point, as you mentioned, you focused on that one classroom, 8B, at Bethune Elementary Middle School. And Bethune was one of 38 schools threatened by the state with closure in 2017 for poor performance. So what does all this school hopping mean come MSTEP time?
Well, in Michigan, schools are not held accountable for their MSTEP scores for any student who wasn't there for the past two count days. So today is count day, and there's another one in February. So a student who isn't in the school for both count days won't be counted on this year's test scores. But the reality is that a student who keeps moving and moving and moving and moving is going to have lower and lower and lower scores. And we had the Detroit Public Schools run numbers for us, and it showed a clear correlation. The more schools you went to, the lower your scores.
And you were just saying that even the students who aren't moving are affected.
Absolutely. So if you're in a classroom where less learning is taking place because of this, you're going to have lower scores.
How does this student churn impact a school's funding?
Well, I mean, 90% of a school's funding is determined on who is enrolled today on count day. But if that student leaves that school today and next week they go somewhere else, that new school is going to take that student in and have the expense of educating that student without most of the funding that would come with that child. If students are coming and going and, you know, schools, it's hard for them to predict how many students they're going to have. It's hard for them to know how many teachers that they should hire. So it destabilizes the whole system. I mean, there was a charter school last week in Detroit that announced suddenly it was going to close. And that was because they, you know, had enrollment projections that said they were going to have a certain number of students. And then fewer than that showed up. And so they just didn't think they were going to have enough students to justify the expense of all the teachers they'd hired. And so they decided to just let people go and find something else. And they did that in late September.
Erin, your story focuses on the Detroit situation, but this isn't just a challenge in Detroit, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, it's definitely more pronounced in Detroit. It's definitely more significant in Detroit, but it's something that's happening all across the country. You know, Milwaukee has a very high rate of student churn, enrollment instability, other cities in Michigan as well. As we've shifted away from the idea that everybody's going to go to their neighborhood school, and we've created all these other options, which in a lot of ways benefit families. You know, you have your charter schools and your magnet schools. There's some benefit to some people as a result of that, but we've created this system that encourages people to move, and so they do.
And you do offer up some ideas, as you call them, simpler, smaller steps that schools and policymakers could take to help ease this student hopping, this school hopping crisis. What are some of these?
Well, I should say that the one thing that would really fix it is better schools, which sounds simplistic. But honestly, if there were a really wonderful school in your neighborhood, or even if it's not in your neighborhood, if your child is enrolled in a great school, you're going to stay. So obviously, if we want to cut down on this, we need to give schools the resources they need to provide the kind of quality education that will give families a reason to stay there and not to keep shopping. Sort of beyond that, something we could maybe do sooner or, you know, more effectively is if we had transportation system, so that if you do move from one side of the city to the other or from one neighborhood to another, you know, maybe you can get a bus that'll take you back to your old school. If we had centralized record keeping, that would certainly ease the transition. So a student shows up in school, if you could quickly access the whole history of that child, you know, their academic transcripts, their test scores, any notes from the previous teacher, like, you know, this child is supposed to be wearing glasses, but he doesn't have them every day. Maybe put him in the front of the class. Really useful tips that teachers in a more stable school pass on to each other because they know each other, because the child's going from the second grade classroom to the third grade classroom next door. So if you could make that digital, that's something you could do.
And as you point out, that Michigan's new record system could be up and operational in 2 or 3 years.
But I don't know how robust it will be. They're doing it incrementally. So currently there's a couple things you could get. You can see their MSTEP scores, but you wouldn't be able to see, you know, their transcripts. And so they're building it. And I think ultimately it will help with this situation, but it takes time, and they've got to unite the data systems of, you know, 800 something school districts.
Well, there's much to read, much to absorb in this very, very worthwhile series reported by Erin Einhorn of Chalkbeat Detroit and Bridge Magazine's Chastity Pratt Dossie. And you will find Moving Costs, How Students Changing Schools Hurt Detroit Classrooms, by going to chalkbeat.org. Erin, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Up next, a new biography details the courageous life of Michigan's First Lady, Betty Ford.
Women started lining up at doctors' offices, calling their doctors to get breast exams because Betty said, you know, early detection is what saved my life.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On August 9th, 1974, Richard Nixon resigned as president. That historic moment thrust Gerald and Betty Ford into the White House, placing the Grand Rapids couple into history as America's 38th president and his first lady. A new biography tracks Betty Ford's life as arguably one of our most influential first ladies. Lisa McCubbin is the New York Times bestselling author of Betty Ford, First Lady, Women's Advocate, Survivor, Trailblazer. Lisa, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Your book covers the entire gamut of Betty Ford's life. So let's go back to those early years as Betty Bloomer grew up in Grand Rapids. What was going on in those early years that portends the very honest, outspoken first lady that she became?
Well, she had a very strong mother figure. Her mother, Hortense Bloomer, was basically a single mom. So Betty had two older brothers, Bill and Bob, and her father was a traveling salesman. So he would be gone for weeks at a time. So her mother really had to raise the kids. And she, you know, she was a strong-willed woman, and I think Betty got a lot of that from her mother. Betty was a tomboy, but then her mother wanted to instill some femininity into her. So when she was 8 years old, she enrolled her in the Calatravis School of Dancing in Grand Rapids. And Betty says that dance was her happiness. From the moment she took her first ballroom dance class wearing black patent leather Mary Jane shoes and white gloves, she loved everything about dance, and then took ballet and tap, and eventually really fell in love with modern dance. She wasn't a great student, but everything she did with dance, she got A pluses.
Well, in fact, as we see in your book, Lisa McCubbin, she winds up going to New York and studying with and dancing for Martha Graham, although she didn't make the A touring company. But how do you think that time as a dancer and as a performer, how did that resonate through her time in the White House as First Lady?
Well, dancing, first of all, gave her tremendous poise and grace and discipline. So much discipline was involved with the dance and just getting everything perfect. So she was a perfectionist in so many ways. And also she loved fashion. She would design her own dance costumes and put on performances when she went back to Grand Rapids. So the dance and the fashion, I think, really contributed to her being this beautiful, lovely, gracious First Lady that she would eventually become.
And she was thrust into the White House when Richard Nixon resigned in August of 1974. She and President Ford never campaigned for this. Did she enjoy the role or not?
You know, she said that the day she entered the White House in 1974 was the saddest day of her life. So she really didn't want this. It was a terrible time in the country. She had been very close friends with Pat Nixon, and she felt terrible for the humiliation that her friend was going through. And she and Gerry Ford felt betrayed by Richard Nixon. So it was really tough, but she blossomed in the White House. And it was just 7 weeks after she became First Lady that she was diagnosed with breast cancer. And that really changed things.
Yeah, we forget that it was so soon. And she broke new ground in the way America talked about and confronted breast cancer.
Absolutely. You know, it's hard to believe now, but in 1974, you couldn't say the word breast on television. When people had cancer, it was just whispered about. Breast cancer was just referred to as a woman's disease. There was no research. There was no walkathons. And literally overnight, when Betty Ford came out publicly and said she was going through this and that she had a mastectomy, literally that changed women's health care overnight. Women started lining up at doctors' offices, calling their doctors to get breast exams because Betty said, you know, early detection is what saved my life and gives me a good prognosis.
And we see very clearly in your book, Betty Ford, that she certainly wrestled with drug and alcohol addictions, prescription drug addictions. And it's almost as if her story of her addiction could be torn from today's headlines when we're so challenged by opioid addiction. So her trouble started with a pinched nerve?
Yes. She had a pinched nerve and was in excruciating pain, had excruciating neck pain, and the doctors said they couldn't operate, so they prescribed prescription pain meds. And when Betty was leaving the hospital, this is when she was in her 40s, she was leaving the hospital and she was so concerned, she asked the doctor, well, what do I do if I'm out somewhere and, you know, the pain comes back? And the doctor said, don't let that happen. Take your medication every 4 hours. So she just, you know, she was following doctor's orders, and she would become accustomed to one level of pain medication, and then they'd have to prescribe something stronger. And, you know, I think this is very common today, and it got to the point where she was taking a lot of different things prescribed by doctors. So, and it was just one doctor. It wasn't like she was going to a bunch of different doctors. You know, she had the White House doctor was giving her all these medications, and some of her assistants who were working with her noticed in the White House that there was something not quite right. After she would take some of her meds, she would be sleepy and her words would be slurred. So they went to the doctor, and he basically told them to mind their own business. You know, it's something that I hope people can learn a lesson from and see the relevance, why it is so easy to become reliant and dependent on prescription drugs. You think, oh, the doctor's prescribing this because it's good for me.
And you open, Lisa McCubbin, you open your book with your Betty Ford biography with the family intervention, when that was a very new thing at the time, when everybody in her family sat down and confronted her not only about her prescription drug abuse, but her drinking, which, as you show us, has some deep roots in her family history.
It did. You know, one thing that I uncovered and something that really the Ford family had never really talked about was that Betty's father died when she was 16. It was an apparent suicide. And at his funeral, she learned that her father had been an alcoholic. It wasn't something she'd ever witnessed because he traveled so much. It would turn out that one of her older brothers also was an alcoholic. So definitely a family disease. And the intervention was so painful for the family, but I spoke with all four of the Ford children, and they were all very open and candid with me. They felt like the time was right to reveal a lot of these really personal stories about their mother that they hadn't before.
And it is stunning when we really see through your book Betty's journey from being so close to dying from her addictions to become a founder of the Betty Ford Center and helping heaven knows how many others to recovery. What was it in her character, do you think, that helped her, gut it out and make that journey to recovery and then on to helping others?
Well, I really think that goes back to her Michigan roots. When she was growing up, her mother was very involved in charitable organizations, and she worked at the Mary Freebed Center. And Betty would go there and work with children who were disabled from polio, and some couldn't move their arms, some couldn't move their legs. And she would come in and put on a record and teach them to dance in whatever way they could. So, you know, she just wanted to help people. She had this compassionate nature, and she had an attitude that, you know, yeah, bad things happen, but it's not the end of the world, and you just need to move forward. And she would always try to find the silver lining in everything. She just had this wonderful attitude.
You know, something that struck me as I read your book, Lisa McCubbin, and it's a theme that we see throughout Betty's life as a political wife, was how absolutely unafraid she was to enjoy friendships and associations with wives from the other side of the aisle, which is very striking in 2018 when we see such intense political polarization. Tell us more about that.
Well, it was a different world in Washington back then. The congressmen all lived in Washington, which they don't these days. So, you know, they're commuting back and forth. Their families basically are living wherever the districts they're from. So back then, the families were all living in Washington, and the wives of the congressmen would become friends. A lot of the kids went to school together. So, you know, kids don't see politics, you know, unless they're taught that from their parents. So they would socialize together, and it really was a completely different environment. The other thing that I discovered while writing this book was this wonderful love story between Gerald and Betty Ford and the admiration and respect they had for each other. Jerry really relied on Betty for a lot of things. He would turn to her for advice, and she would give it. And it wasn't always along party lines. And she would say things in the press that maybe might make him cringe, but he would support her fully by saying, well, she is a woman and she has her own mind and she has every right to say what she believes in.
What most touched you as you researched and wrote your account of Betty Ford's life?
Oh, gosh, what most touched me? The most touching part was when I was writing about President Ford's funeral. And I just felt this overwhelming sadness because she lost her true love and her boyfriend. She called him her boyfriend until the day he died. And that was a really touching moment for me to kind of research what went on with the funeral and how strong she was and this tremendous sense of loss of losing her great love.
Where do you think she stands in the pantheon of America's first ladies?
Oh, well, she's my favorite, no doubt about that. But, I think many historians have said that Betty Ford's legacy is one of few first ladies who outshines her husband. And she just the impact she's had on women's health and then on addiction treatment and alcoholism, the hundreds of thousands of lives she has saved by using her platform to speak out and do good in the world. You know, she didn't just put her name on the Betty Ford Center. She was there every day. She was talking to patients. Her vision is still there everywhere, and she was just beloved by people who worked there and still work there.
Lisa McCubbin, her book is Betty Ford, First Lady, Woman's Advocate, Survivor, Trailblazer. Thank you so much for sharing this with us.
Oh, thank you. Hope everybody gets a chance to read it.
Lisa McCubbin will talk about her book, Betty Ford, this Thursday at Albion College and Friday at the Ford School at the University of Michigan. Details are on her website, lisamccubbin.com. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Today, Governor Snyder announced an agreement with Enbridge Energy that could eventually lead to the company replacing its aging Line 5 pipeline with a new one through a tunnel beneath the Straits of Mackinac. Here's what Keith Cray, director of the Department of Natural Resources, has to say about it.
That tunnel actually acts as secondary containment. It's about 100 feet into the bedrock. So that separates, in my words, commodity and resource. And as natural resource director, I think that's an important step to take.
If all goes according to this agreement, the construction is expected to take up to 10 years and cost anywhere from $350 million to $600 million. And Enbridge, which is one of Michigan Radio's many corporate sponsors, says it will pay for it. Mike Schreiberg directs the National Wildlife Federation's Great Lakes Regional Center, and he is a member of Michigan's Pipeline Safety Advisory Board. Mike, what is your reaction to today's announcement?
Yeah, well, we think this announcement missed the boat. We think that the governor actually failed to address what's the key issue, which is how do we protect the Great Lakes right now? Tunnel may or may not ever be built, but we know we have an existential threat to the Great Lakes that is Line 5, and this agreement does little to nothing to actually protect against that.
Now, the governor says, in his view, it makes sense to get that oil and gas pipeline off the bottom of the straits, put it in that underground tunnel, and while you're at it, you could use it for other infrastructure things, pipelines and cables. Is there merit to that part of the argument?
Well, you know, over the long term, that may or may not be a good solution. The problem is this agreement actually provides no guarantee that this would actually happen. And while this is being debated, and imagine this is at least a decade, if not more, if you just think about the lawsuits and the other things that will go on, Enbridge is allowed just free rein with the Straits of Mackinac and the Great Lakes. They have shown that they don't deserve that level of responsibility for the Great Lakes. So we're very disappointed that the governor didn't listen to his advisory board and the people of the state of Michigan on this.
So let me ask you about that. Was the advisory board consulted in this in any substantive way?
So yes, the advisory board was consulted. I was able to provide comments to the governor as a member of that, and so were others. From what I can tell, the one member of the advisory board that the governor really listened to, though, was Enbridge. Enbridge sits on that board, and when I look at the outcome, I think it's really what Enbridge wanted. It's not what those representing the conservation resources of the state and the people of the state wanted.
With that in mind, what was the point of having the advisory board, in your view?
I think to provide some input. You know, it's obviously the governor's decision whether he takes that or not. And he took the input from the corporate entities on there. I'm not sure he took the other input.
So if you were to say, not this, but this, what would you rather see happen that would protect the Great Lakes?
Yeah, so what we advocated for is two things. One, in the very short term, additional measures to make sure Line 5 is safe. Right now, there's coating that's missing on it. We've got problems with it. We know that the anchor has hit it. And so we have to make sure it's 100% safe right now.
And what would those measures look like?
Well, those would be not using the pipeline until it's been fully inspected. That hasn't happened. There's been no independent review. But in the very short term, you could actually shut down Line 5 in less than a year. All you need to do is put some of the economic alternatives in place to Line 5. What we know now is that the very few services that Line 5 provides to the state of Michigan, there are good substitutes for that. It would take you less than a year to put those in place. If you have that, and if Line 5 is decommissioned during that time, then you have leverage with Enbridge to discuss a tunnel. The governor kind of reversed that process, and I think it's a strategic error.
What would those economic backup plans look like?
Yeah, so propane to the UP. Less than 1% of Line 5 provides propane. It's actually pretty easy because trucking and rail can provide that propane, that same amount, and at a price difference that wouldn't even be noticed by consumers. Similarly, Line 5 provides a way for oil produced in northern Michigan to get to market. You could replace that with rail, and it wouldn't have an impact to those producers. So the few things that Line 5 provides has perfect substitutes. Of course, there aren't any substitutes for the Great Lakes, and that's the message that we're trying to get through to the governor.
So what now? What comes next?
Well, what comes next is unclear. This was an interim agreement. The governor has said that his goal is to finalize an agreement with Enbridge before the end of his term for the tunnel. If you actually look at the text of this agreement, which I just did, it actually just says that the state's going to initiate discussions on a tunnel. There's no commitment here. There's nothing binding. And I think we probably look to future administrations and future governors to see what happens here.
Well, timing-wise, I mean, we're very late in the Snyder term, and the clock is ticking. We've only got mere weeks left.
Yeah, I think the net effect is this kicks the can down the road. You know, this may sound harsh, but I think this agreement was both misguided and toothless because it actually doesn't do very much. What it does do, I think, is in the wrong direction, but there's nothing binding in here at all. And from my perspective, that might be the good news in this.
Mike Schreiberg, National Wildlife Federation's Great Lakes Regional Center, and a member of Michigan's Pipeline Safety Advisory Board. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Enbridge put out a statement today reading in part, and I quote, "Under the agreement, Enbridge has committed to a range of measures to protect the Straits of Mackinac and the Great Lakes, including exploring with the state a new pipeline in a tunnel deep under the straits. Placing a pipeline in a tunnel would reduce the likelihood of a release of oil into the straits to near zero and eliminate the potential for an anchor strike. The agreement with the state reflects Enbridge's steadfast commitment to protecting the Great Lakes while safely meeting Michigan's energy needs." Still to come, just who will pay to clean up PFAS chemicals around Michigan? We'll seek answers after the break. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Continuing our week-long look into the PFAS crisis enveloping Michigan, and today we're looking at the dollars and cents. Odey Salim is with us now. He's a clinical assistant professor at the University of Michigan Law School, where he directs the Environmental Law and Sustainability Clinic. Professor, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So when we ask Stateside listeners for their questions about PFAS, here's one that we heard a lot. Let's take a listen.
Hi, my name is Scott. I'm calling from Parchment, Michigan. Obviously, you may have heard my town is in the news as being the only municipal water source in the state of Michigan that has PFAS in it. So I am very affected by it. So I'd just like to know how to fund a project to clean up the source of the problem.
So basically, who's going to pay to clean up all of these messes around Michigan?
It's a great question, and this is obviously a very complex topic. You all have devoted so much attention to it, which is really great, as have multiple outlets in Michigan. Let me just begin by saying what we're not talking about. So we're here talking about mostly PFAS and their effect on drinking water that humans consume. We're not here talking about wildlife and whether aquatic organisms and the communities that live in our streams and our lakes, how much PFAS they can put up with and the effect on them. That's a whole other segment, and who pays for the care of those critters is something that's also worth discussing, but we're not going to be talking about that today. The other thing that we're not talking about today is we're here talking about being in reactive mode. This is when the PFAS chemicals have already been released into the environment, and now we're all reacting to that and figuring out who will pay to react to it, who will pay to
remediate it. Because the more we look, the more we find.
That's right. So what we're not talking about is we're not talking about the upstream world. How does PFAS chemicals even get into the stream of commerce and our environment? Why are they so plentiful all around us? How did they get there? Why are they still allowed? But to get to the excellent question, I think the way to think about it is to use a couple of examples. The example that I like to use, the caller was from Parchment, and that, of course, is just a horrendous example of environmental contamination that involves PFAS. Let me actually talk about an example that's a little bit closer to the studio here in Ann Arbor and talk about what's happening in Wixom and what's happening with the Ann Arbor water supply. I think that if I go through that example with you, it'll help explain the different component parts of the contamination and who pays for which part.
Indeed, because some state lawmakers are calling on the governor to shut down and auto parts supplier based in Wixom that is the source of this PFAS contamination in the Huron River. So if that pollution comes from a specific business, does that business pay for the cleanup? What does the law say?
That's a great question. So first of all, let's understand the context here. That business produces PFAS chemicals, and those PFAS chemicals will get discharged into the sewer system in Wixom. The sewage treatment plant in Wixom receives sewer discharges from all kinds of businesses and industries within the city of Wixom. That's how these sewage treatment plants work. Now, of course, what they mostly receive is they mostly receive sewage, and that's what they're built to treat. That's why sewage treatment plants have solid separation and bacteria to treat that sewage. So when you have an industry, when businesses also discharging different kinds of chemicals, organic chemicals and other industrial chemicals into the system, the treatment plant isn't necessarily prepared for it. So first of all, you have businesses discharging to the sewer system, the publicly owned treatment work. Then you have the sewage treatment plant treating what it can and then discharging into a creek. In that case, it's Norton Creek. Norton Creek is a tributary to the Huron River. The Huron River ultimately bends its way and gets to Ann Arbor and is the water supply for the city of Ann Arbor. So then the drinking water system in Ann Arbor takes that water, does its treatment, and then gives it to its residents. So let's look at each of those component parts of the issue. Let's begin with what you asked about, which is the automotive supplier and what can be done about the automotive supplier. Who pays? Well, the question, first of all, is the automotive supplier doing anything wrong, and are they liable, and should they pay for doing something wrong? So the sewage treatment plant that receives the automotive supplier's discharge is part of the Clean Water Act's pretreatment program. So every time you have a sewage treatment plant, you have to have a pretreatment program because those sewage treatment plants are going to be receiving chemicals that they cannot treat appropriately. So they need the dischargers themselves, the businesses that are discharging into the sewage system, to do the pretreatment for those chemicals. Otherwise, those chemicals will either interfere with the sewage treatment process or simply pass right through the plant untreated and straight into the river. So it's clear in this case that the city of Wixom, which operates the sewage treatment plant, had a responsibility to make sure that there were limits in place on chemicals like the PFAS family of chemicals so that the automotive discharger did not put them into the stream. So you actually have two parties that could potentially be at fault, because what happened in Wixom, of course, is that you measure the PFAS level, specifically PFOS. It's one of the chemicals in the PFAS family. You measure PFOS in Norton Creek. And as my good friend Laura Rubin, the director of the Huron River Watershed Council, I think said, the level is astronomical. I think the level was over 5,000 parts per trillion when the standard is about 12. So the question is, well, whose fault is that? Well, I think you could look at both the city of Wixom and that automotive supplier as sharing the fault. My questions are, first of all, did the automotive supplier know that it was putting those PFAS chemicals into the sewage system? Did it have standards that applied to it in order to treat the chemicals before they got to the treatment plant? Did the treatment plant appropriately put limits in its industrial pretreatment program laws to make sure that those PFAS chemicals never get to the sewage treatment plant and then ultimately into Norton Creek?
When you think about industry, let's just talk about the plating industry, because it's a big source of PFAS contamination.
Yes.
PFAS were used to mitigate toxic fumes that were seen as a threat to worker safety. So if a company was required to use PFAS by either state or federal regulations as a way to limit hazards or pollution, are they legally liable now?
It's a great question. Ultimately, when it gets into a stream, we have standards. And whether they were required to use something or not is one thing, but whether they should have used it and cleaned it up in time before it got to the stream is another. So even where companies are doing it because it's the best practice or even because they're required to, that's the use of the chemical, not the discharge into a water body of the chemical once it's been discarded. So those are two different things. And so, no, it doesn't absolve them of liability. So in the case of Wixom, you've got the supplier, and I've got some questions about the supplier, and maybe the supplier is to some extent liable for putting too much PFOS in the stream. Maybe the sewage treatment plant is liable because if it has a Clean Water Act permit, and that permit requires that the sewage treatment plant not cause the water body to exceed levels for PFOS, it could be liable too. Now, the interesting question here is we're still talking about drinking water and human consumption. So at the end of the day, not that that doesn't matter, the state or citizens mm-hmm. under the Clean Water Act could potentially go after either the supplier or the sewage treatment plant for violating the Clean Water Act. Now, what would you get out of that? You would certainly, I think, get remediation. You would get the problem to stop.
Right.
But you're not necessarily going to take those chemicals out of the stream. They're there.
They're there.
They're in the tissue of the aquatic organisms. Mm-hmm. They're in the water column. Nothing easily is going to take those chemicals out. But you can at least get the harm to maybe
stop.
And not exacerbate. You can also ask the company or the sewage treatment plant or both pay fines that go to the treasury. They don't go to the people mm-hmm. who may suffer from it, not the aquatic organisms,
not the
humans. To the
state treasury?
Well, if it depends on where you bring the lawsuit and who's bringing it, but it could be either the state or the federal treasury. And then you could obviously get a finding of liability. The interesting question is this. If it's the case that in Wixom and perhaps in other places along the Huron River, companies and sewage treatment plants are contributing to the PFAS chemicals in the river, including PFOS, and those chemicals ultimately get to Ann Arbor's water supply. Ann Arbor is going to have to pay a lot of money to upgrade its treatment system. I've heard estimates of up to $1 million, maybe more, to get this very advanced carbon treatment system. Well, who pays for that? Mm-hmm. Well, when you have a public drinking water system and the residents of your city are paying for that water, guess what? They pay for it. This isn't a private company that has private shares. This is a public drinking water system. And usually what happens is that when a public drinking water system's costs go up, they raise their rates on their residents.
Your bills are higher.
Your bills are higher. And what does that do? You know, some people can afford those bills and it's okay. Mm-hmm. But guess what? That's a disproportionate impact on people who are often in poor economic circumstances. No matter who they are, that puts extra stress on their households. And so the question is, can the city of Ann Arbor recover the cost of that treatment from Wixom or from the company or from other people upstream?
What about businesses that no longer exist?
Well, yes. So for businesses that no longer exist, that's an interesting question that relates to another Michigan law, which is called Part 201. Part 201 is part of the Natural Resources Environmental Protection Act in Michigan. And Part 201 concentrates on remediation once the environmental damage has been done. There's another statute that regulates waste and chemicals to try to prevent them from getting into the environment in levels that could be dangerous. But once they're there, we have Part 201, and Part 201 requires remediation. Michigan, if you recall, Michigan actually decided abruptly to adopt a health advisory level of 70 parts per trillion mm-hmm. that the Environmental Protection Agency had. It decided to adopt that level as Michigan's groundwater cleanup level, where what you have is PFAS chemicals getting into groundwater, and then those PFAS chemicals in groundwater getting into people's private water wells.
Right.
And the idea was, well, you should, in the groundwater itself, you should not allow the PFAS chemical levels to get above 70 for fear that people will draw that water into their private wells, drink it, and be harmed by it.
And there are those who feel that level's too high.
Oh, there are many who feel that level's too high. I'm one of them.
Yes.
And, you know, we need a lot of work in Michigan on figuring out what the appropriate levels are. I can get back to what we call drinking water levels for public systems a little bit later, if you like. But for now, to answer your question about what happens when the company goes away, no longer exists, it was an old company, under Part 201, the liability attaches to facilities. And facilities is the term used in Part 201, and that's a very broadly defined term. That can mean current owners and operators or simply people who happen to own the land today that's contributing to the problem, even if those people didn't themselves dump the barrels or do anything else wrong to get the chemicals into the groundwater.
This is not a neat and clean answer at all that says so-and-so pays because you have PFAS in your water.
Think about it. If you have a company that's done something wrong and put chemicals into the groundwater and the levels of those chemicals violate mm-hmm. a standard by the state, let's think about who might pay and how they'll be required to pay. I mean, of course, anybody can just pay voluntarily. There are a lot of responsible corporate actors out there who admit they're wrong, and they work with families and others
up.
Who are affected. They pony up. But there are many who don't. And so how can you get them to pay and who pays? Well, first of all, you have the entity itself that could pay. Mm-hmm. maybe the state will go after them to enforce Part 201. Maybe the citizens themselves who are affected by the drinking water standard will go after them in lawsuits. You know, we see that obviously in other places in Michigan, where you have class actions brought with the help of attorneys brought against these companies to pay costs that are not just about remediation. Mm-hmm. These people have spent money to get, for example, temporary bottled water to drink while they're in fear of drinking their current water. They may be getting medical testing, blood testing to figure out whether there's anything wrong with them. They may be getting treatment to their water well, just in case PFOS or PFAS is coming through. And by the way, they're worried about their home values. They may have to sell their home one day, and now the value is reduced because everybody knows that there's a chemical running beneath the house. So sometimes citizens will sue. Sometimes the state will go after the company and force the company to remediate. And then, of course, there are sometimes insurance companies. Insurance companies, depending on the insurance coverage, may step in to assist the company to pay out some of these costs.
I'm hearing many, many different avenues. If you were to boil all of this down to the most concise piece of advice to give a homeowner like Scott that we heard from Parchment who has this concern, what would it be?
Boy, I think I would give two pieces of advice. The first piece of advice would be, please communicate with the people who run your water system, if it's a public water system. Please communicate with your state representatives, with your federal representatives. Let them know exactly what's going on. Let them know why it's a concern to you. Because one thing that we don't have yet in this country, throughout the country, is we don't have the Federal Environmental Protection Agency or states coming up with standards for public water systems, especially, and the drinking water levels there. As far as I know, there are only a couple of states, I think New Jersey may be one of them, that has any enforceable limit on what goes through a public water system with regard to a PFAS chemical. The other piece of advice I would give is talk to somebody who understands these things. You may have a watershed association that's near you. You may have an attorney whom you trust. You may have somebody else in your community who has gone through these groundwater issues. But it's really important to start the conversation right away because, as you say, it is a complex matter. I think there are a lot of people in the public right now who don't know how much PFAS is too much because, of course, there's no such thing as PFAS, right? There are PFAS chemicals, and it depends on which PFAS chemical and how much and whether it's just in the groundwater or whether it's in your water well, whether you're on a public system, whether you're on a private system, whether you should go ahead and spend the money to get pretty expensive treatment, and will the treatment even work? There's a lot the public doesn't know, and so I would suggest that people in that position talk to the community organizations and others around them who are in the know and who can provide at least some of that introductory information that they would need to get going. But this is not easy.
Professor, earlier this year, the state of Minnesota settled with 3M, one of the leading manufacturers of PFAS, including Scotchgard, that Wolverine Worldwide dumped into the areas near Grand Rapids. And the company agreed to pay $850 million. Some reports have concluded that amount will go a long way toward making drinking water safer, but won't do much to remediate the pollution in the environment. What has Minnesota's case shown us regarding holding PFAS manufacturers responsible?
Well, it's shown us, I think, a couple of things. One, it's shown us that what the state does and how motivated the state is to deal with the problem is really important because sometimes it's enough for a state to simply study an issue and maybe even develop some standards. But sometimes it's really important for the state to step in and to enforce their standards aggressively and vigorously on behalf of their citizens. So I think one thing that it teaches us is that state involvement in this issue is crucial because often the citizens who are affected are the ones who don't have the resources to fight back. And I think the second thing that it teaches us is you're talking about big figures. You know, you just gave the figure of, what was it, $850 million?
That's right.
So nearly $1 billion. And we know that that's not going to satisfy everybody and completely remediate the environment. So the other lesson is this. When you deal with something like groundwater contamination or surface water contamination, we have standards that are based on the way that we use the groundwater and the surface water. So if humans are drinking from it, there may be a certain level that's safe, but above that, it's not. There may be aquatic organisms who have to live in that environment, and so there may be a level that's safe, and above it, it's not. But what's clear is that in our world and in our country and the way that we've developed our policies on environmental remediation, the policy is almost never to just remove the hazardous chemicals entirely from the environment. The policy is always, let's remove as much of it as possible to make the uses of that particular water safe enough for humans and aquatic organisms. And one of the reasons for that is because we don't have the policies that we need to prevent those chemicals from getting into the environment to begin with. We continue to be a reactive culture, not a proactive culture and a preventative culture when it comes to chemicals like the PFAS family of chemicals.
Odey Salim is a clinical assistant professor at the U of M Law School, where he's the director of the Environmental Law and Sustainability Clinic. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin, engineered by Mike Blank. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Sam Corey, Joy Horan, Sarah Leeson, Natalie Brennan, Isabella Isaacs, and a special thanks to Shana Roth. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.